We're going to begin by something that amused me. It's Associated Press. I think I got it from the B. With a Russian frigate closing in, this is from Nairobi, Kenya, Associated Press. With a Russian frigate closing in and a half dozen U.S. warships within shouting distance, the pirates holding a tanker off Somalia's coast might appear to have no other choice than to wave the white flag. But that's not how it works in Somalia, a failed state where a quarter of the children die before they turn five, where anyone with a gun controls the streets, and where every public institution is crumbled. The 11-day standoff aboard the Ukrainian MV Farina raises the question, how can a bunch of criminals from one of the poorest and most wretched countries on earth face off with some of the world's richest and well-armed superpowers? Ted Dagny, a Somali analyst in Washington, told the Associated Press, here's how they do it. They have enough guns to fight for another 20 years. In Somalia, pilots are better funded, better organized, and better armed than you might imagine in a country that's been in tatters for nearly two decades. They have the support of their communities and rogue members of the government. Some pirates even promise to put ransom money towards building roads and schools. With most attacks ending with million-dollar payouts, piracy is considered the biggest economy in Somalia. Pirates rarely hurt their hostages, instead holding out for huge paydays. The strategy works well. A report Thursday by a London-based think tank said pirates in Somalia have raked in up to $30 million in ransom this year alone. You and I are in the wrong business, folks. All right, my commentary for today, October the 8th. It's dedicated to listeners everywhere, people driving to Yuba City, and all the ships at sea. Achtung, Achtung! Nevada County's Titty Patrol will now assemble. Not content to try to ban nude bathing in remote parts of the Yuba River, the Titty Patrol is now harassing mothers who have the audacity to breastfeed their infants in public. Earth to Titty Patrol. Your head has a feature you may not be aware of. It swivels on an appendage known as your neck. If you see something that offends you, please utilize this feature by swiveling your head and looking somewhere else, and leave the rest of us in peace. Next item. It's the economy, stupid. Whatever that is. Further proof that we live on a planet of the insane. BBC reports that stock markets all over the world are experiencing major panic as investors try to get out. I wasn't even aware that some of those countries had stock markets. It seems that many countries share the American lust for gambling on whether pieces of paper signifying ownership in and of nothing will go up or down in value. But obviously they do. Instead of investing their spare cash in real items or benefiting their communities, they play the stock markets, gamble rather than invest in their communities. And please remember the cardinal rule of gambling casinos: the house never loses. Players play, but the casino and its owners aren't playing. It's always a stacked deck. The house always wins. You guys can be players. You can win or lose. But the investment house top executives are the real owners, and they always win. And lest you own stock in a corporation and naively believe you can influence its policies, try to take back the obscene stock options, bonuses, and golden parachutes your company gives out to its top executives as they are busy looting the company. You decide zilch. They decide all. And all for themselves. Stockholders be damned. You want proof? Try this one. File this under Truth is Indeed Stranger Than Fiction. This is from the Associated Press writer Julie Hirschfield Davis. It's titled Layman Sought Millions for Execs While Seeking Aid. As Congress began investigating what went so wrong on Wall Street to prompt a $700 billion government bailout, lawmakers learned Monday that the now-bankrupt investment bank Lehman Brothers arranged millions in bonuses for fired executives at the very time it was pleading for a federal lifeline. The panel unearthed internal documents showing that on September 11th, Lehman planned to approve special payments worth $18.2 million for two executives who were terminated involuntarily, which means fired, and another $5 million for one who was leaving on his own. That was just 4 days before the government let Lehman go under, touching off a cascading series of financial shocks and failures that put Washington on track for the multi-billion-dollar rescue the Bush administration urgently requested from Congress at the end of the week. Richard S. Fode, Jr., the Lehman chief executive, said a compensation system that he estimated paid him about $350 million between 2000 and 2007. Even as the company headed for disaster, he felt that was appropriate. Chairman Waxman released email correspondence from June 2008 in which Fold dismissed the suggestion from executives at a Lehman subsidiary that the company's top people forego bonuses to, quote, send a strong message to both employees and investors that management is not shirking accountability for recent performance, close quote. Fold wrote back, don't worry, there are only people who think about their own pockets. The suggestion came from executives at Lehman's money management subsidiary, Neuberger Berman, who also were recommending that Lehman spin off its business to insulate its employees and their bonuses from Lehman's sagging stock price and from management mistakes. George H. Walker, President Bush's cousin and a member of Lehman's executive committee, breezily shot down the ideas, according to the emails. Walker wrote to the rest of the executive committee, sorry, team, I'm not sure what's in the water at Neuberger Berman. I'm embarrassed and I apologize. Well now, Congressional Committee publicly embarrasses one chief executive who walks out of the hearing with his $350 million intact. What's wrong with his picture? Speaking of pictures, when I was a child, I used to frequent the Saturday matinees at the movies. Along with cartoons and a feature movie, they always had the movie tone news. And I recall scenes of the communist takeover in China, where the victorious revolutionaries herded together rich landowners and those they considered greedy enemies of the people, took them out into the fields and shot them. Drastic times call for drastic measures. Now, I'm not advocating executing these Wall Street bandits, but I do think forcing them to return their ill-gotten gains would be reasonable, and Congress does nothing. Please remember that at election time. If you vote for any incumbent congressperson, you're condoning their behavior. I have heard many a voter claim they will refuse to vote for any incumbent on the ballot this November. Capitalism. Not a theory in textbooks, but is really practiced. You got to admire the chutzpah of these guys. Okay, we've got a caller that's been patient. Caller, you're live on the air. You're live on the air.
Thank you very much. This is an idea of projection. Here we have a Greg Palast book, and here are some things. Catherine Harris says, twisted and maniacal. You'll get my point in a second. Sean Hannity, Fox Radio, says, Palast, you're a putz. And then, we also have...
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to get to your point.
Okay, that there's this thing about, like, projecting onto others when it's maybe kind of yourself. So in relationship to that, you have the Conservative Party, and I think they should have kept the... Jackson Brown should have let him keep that song running on empty, because I think it's appropriate.
You know, you're all over the map.
You didn't
please
get any
get
of
to
that?
Your point. No, huh? No, I didn't.
Were you listening?
I'm trying.
You are. You're good. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, I'm going to make a request. If somebody wants to call in, please be succinct and to the point, and you might want to make some notes before you get on air. Because I do not want to be impolite, but we've got thousands of people listening, and radio time is valuable. So please get to your points. Thanks. Okay, back to my commentary. Well now, the Congressional Committee publicly embarrasses one chief executive who walks out of the hearing with his $300 million intact. What's wrong with this picture? Okay, I was back further. Drastic times call for drastic measures. I'm not advocating... executing these Wall Street bandits, but I do think forcing them to return their ill-gotten gains would be reasonable. Congress does nothing. Please remember that at election time. Next item. Well, election season is in high gear. I didn't watch last night's presidential debate, but I did watch the vice presidential so-called debate. The people who should have been before the cameras, the people with new ideas to rescue our floundering republic, well, they were absent. Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, Mike Gravel have been successfully marginalized. They no longer exist in the public consciousness. So we're left with the hand-picked candidates the elitists have selected for us to fret over. Our system of pseudo-democracy worked once again. But I digress. My disgust with the system got in the way of my telling you of my take on the great vice presidential candidate debate. I wanted to get a feel for Sarah Palin, so I watched. I was not disappointed. The Republican presidential election strategy is as simple as it is brilliant. Ignore issues, ignore policy, forget past ineptitude, abandon logic. Simply provide a candidate the average Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife can identify with. Sarah Palin is terrific at playing that role. To establish my hypothesis, let's first look at the positive side of George W. Bush. I know that's a difficult concept, but bear with me. George Bush's primary attribute is that he's likable. He may not be too bright, but he comes across as just plain folks. He, unlike most politicians, is obviously not smarter than the average voter and doesn't pretend to be. He doesn't flaunt his education or wisdom or experience or expertise. He doesn't talk down to people. The average American feels they could sit down with George at any bar or living room, have a beer, and feel right at home. That's very comforting to non-thoughtful voters. In spite of the fact that George W. was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and never did an honest day's work in his life, he manages to convey the image that he's just like us, just plain folks. Non-thinking voters like that, a lot. This strategy has worked for 8 years. In spite of everything he's allowed to happen while pretending to run our country, some Americans still find him likable. The amazing fact is a lot of people voted for him, not once, but twice. Not enough to elect him, of course. Both his elections were demonstrably stolen. But a large number of Americans did vote for him, and many would vote for him again. One could make the point that most of his votes came from people that vote straight party line, no matter who the candidate might be. These robots would have voted for Attila the Hun or even Hitler if they'd been the Republican nominee. But the amazing fact remains that George W. Bush did have and still has some appeal to many voters. In that important regard, the protesters waving placards in Alaska are correct. Sarah Palin is George W. Bush in lipstick. Her debate performance was nothing short of masterful. She presented herself as a mother, a housewife, a hockey mom, an aw shucks, no highfalutin nonsense, just plain one of us sort of person. Time and again, she ducked answering the questions regarding policy, issues, or any specific things she and McCain would actually do if elected. You know, all the things intelligent voters should be concentrating on. As she stuck to, vote for me and John because we, and especially I, are more likable, more like you than those other guys. Her facial expressions were terrific. She is absolutely masterful at appearing charming. If you were watching carefully, you should have noticed that several times she ended a comment by winking at the camera. That was so cool. Charming? Even sexy? You bet your sweet patooties she was. Forget the issues. At least one Republican strategist has even admitted this campaign is not about issues, and Sarah Palin proves it. She gave a masterful performance. Will she win the election for the GOP? Only election counting machines know for sure. Perhaps the most astounding part of the pseudo-debate was when Palin changed the rules. Here's John Diaz in the San Francisco Chronicle. Say this for Sarah Palin, the Alaska governor knows how to shelter herself from public scrutiny, even when debating on national television. Early on, she turned to Senator Joe Biden and brazenly announced, I may not answer the questions the way you or the moderator wants to hear. I'm talking directly to the American people. In case you missed it, talking directly to the American people meant deflecting direct questions by retreating to the comfort of talking points about Democrats raising taxes, the detachment of the Washington elite from the concerns of Joe Sixpack, and repeated reminders of how she and John McCain were true mavericks of this race. My comment. So there's Sarah Palin. She's indeed a maverick in that she doesn't play by the rules. She invents her own. More from John Diaz. Interestingly, it was Palin, not Biden, who made a point of her recent arrival to national politics. It came in response to moderator Gwen Ifill's question about whether which campaign promises she might have to reconsider in light of the financial crises. How long have I been at this? Like 5 weeks? Palin replied. 5 weeks. Wow. So to know who Sarah Palin is, we have to go to her record as a mayor in a town of 6,000 and a brief stint as governor of the oil-rich state of Alaska. She required women in Wasilla to pay for their own medical examinations after being raped. She cut funding for teen moms and for comprehensive sex education. She also believes that if a woman or girl becomes pregnant due to rape or incest, she must carry that child to term and give birth to the child she was forced to conceive. I'm not a woman, so I'll never know. But I really question what it must do to a woman, or worse still, to an immature girl, to have a child growing inside you that was conceived by force. Will that child be raised with love or bitterness? I realize that abortion is a very sensitive issue for many thoughtful people. But until I hear the anti-abortionists are willing to take the new and unwanted child and care for it until it is an adult, I feel they're failing to walk their talk. If you force a woman to give birth to an unwanted child, then logically, you must be willing to take over the care of that child. To not do so is to abandon that child you've brought into the world. Do we really need more unwanted children in our world? Next item is from thecosmicpath.com. Last week I wrote about preventing foreclosures by making sure the bank can prove who owns the paper. I received the following email from a woman who's in process of developing a website to assist people facing foreclosure. And she quotes, "I wanted to validate your mentioning that some judges are not allowing a foreclosure to proceed based on the fact that the lending bank has to prove who now owns the paper, and most often they can't. I successfully assisted a friend in stopping her foreclosure by filing a lawsuit against IndyMac based on this principle. I'm a paralegal. We're hoping to initiate a blog and start assisting people who don't have the knowledge of how to do this. It's totally legal and it works." Back to thecosmicpath.com. It makes sense. Why should a bank be able to foreclose if they can't prove who owns the paper, or if they only own 2% of your mortgage, or are collecting the money when they don't know who actually owns it? They shouldn't be able to seize your whole house, only 2% of it. As the banks continue to collapse and merge, expect the ownership paperwork to get even messier and more misplaced. Spread the word. Remember, the money in the market didn't disappear. Someone took the money off the table, put it in their pocket, and walked away with it. Where, oh where, did all the money go? Where, oh where, is the $700 billion our Congress agreed to hand over to the Treasury Secretary, who's a former Wall Street banker? Where is it going? Whose pockets are going to be filled with your tax dollars? As I said when I first saw Palin's chart, the woman makes Dick Cheney look like a kindergartner. John McCain is old, doddering, erratic, and has multiple bouts of a very malignant cancer. He's losing it before your very eyes. This woman will be your president when McCain dies in office. Do you want her finger on the button? You know she's capable of killing 40 caribou at a time. She banned books in the library. She got her brother-in-law fired from his job. She made rape women pay for their rape kits. Another governor from an oil-rich state, more the same as George Bush. She's Dick Cheney in a dress. We've had 8 years of a guy who you want to have a beer with. You want 4 more years of a gal you can go hunt with? How about going for intelligence for a change? Okay, that was thecosmicpath.com. Addendum. If you swallow your indignation and step back a few paces and look at this economic meltdown that is becoming worldwide, the absurdity of the whole system is hard to miss. The world seems built on credit and banks loaning money that doesn't exist to other banks in order for them to loan it to businesses and people. The banks create paper money out of thin air, backed by nothing of intrinsic value, and then pass it around from one to another, skimming off profit at every transaction. Notice that nothing of real value is produced. Then government, which is little more than the enforcement arm of the banks, taxes you of money you earned by producing items of real value or services that you really do require. What an incredible system. And it's crashing down as we watch. If you were watching from your spacecraft, you could only marvel at the complex nonsense we earthlings have created. A few people grow food or produce items of real value. The vast majority churn out mounds of paper or computer entries signifying nothing. Paraphrasing Willie Shakespeare, sound and fury signifying nothing. Related item. As I type this, NPR News is in the background. The nation of Iceland is bankrupt. How the hell can a country go bankrupt? Did they run out of ice? Another news anomaly. Did you notice that whenever stock markets go up, the statistics trumpeted are, the stock market rose by so many points. It's a large number, usually in the hundreds. Now, as stock markets worldwide are going down, the statistics given are in percentages, which is a small number, usually single digits. Subtle mind manipulation. On the other hand, what do I really expect corporate media to tell us? Chicken Little was right, the sky is falling? Okay, enough with the economy. Next item. I found an interesting article in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's titled Cotton Kills. It made the point that if you're hiking in the high country, even in mild sunny weather, wear synthetic or woolen clothing, not cotton. Weather conditions can change very rapidly in the high country, and it seems that cotton, when wet, not only has no insulating value, but it wicks heat away from your body, and it's also very slow in drying. The article made the point that you do not have to be in even near freezing temperatures to fall victim of hypothermia. It seems that most hypothermia cases are caused by temperatures in the 40s, which is far from freezing. Next item. There's an issue that's sticking in my craw, so it's time to mention it. John McCain as war hero. What is a hero? The definition I was raised with is that a hero does something far more than what is expected of the normal person. In military jargon, it's called above and beyond the call of duty. John McCain was trained as a military bomber pilot, served in Vietnam, and was shot down over Hanoi. He was simply doing the job he was trained and paid to do, and he had the misfortune to get shot down and the good fortune to live through it. He was captured and was then kept in prison for I forgot how many years, under reportedly terrible conditions as a prisoner of war. He was reportedly tortured, although there are some claims that he received favorable treatment after he confessed to war crimes. We'll leave that aside, for that's not my point here. My point is that he did not volunteer for that terrible experience. He was there by circumstance. As far as I can discern, he did absolutely nothing above or beyond the call of duty. He found himself in very bad circumstances, and he endured. To do so is neither brave nor heroic. It is nothing more than survival instincts leading to common sense. John McCain survived a terrible experience, and for that he deserves our empathy. He served our country in a war that we may or may not believe was just, but he believed in it, and for that he deserves our respect, if not gratitude. But that does not make him a hero. He did not fall on a grenade, sacrificing his life for those of his comrades. He did not single-handedly charge up a hill to take out a machine gun nest. He simply did the job he was trained and paid to do, and in doing so, he got captured and imprisoned. Bad luck? Certainly. Heroic? Not in my book. Now for an interesting take on the possible state of McCain's mental health as a result of his horrifying war and prisoner of war experience. The following article is by one of my favorite essayist blogsters, Fred Reed, writing in Fred on Everything. Fred often has a unique take on current topics. This is his opinion on an aspect of John McCain. I warn you that some of the images he evokes are not pretty. This is not for the young nor the squeamish. Fred titles it, Is McCain Able? Electing a Head Case. I frankly don't believe John McCain's medical records, or at any rate the portions released to the New York Times. The man was held in solitary for years, tortured until bones fractured, until he confessed to war crimes, until he tried to hang himself. That he broke can't be held against him. Almost anyone would have. In my view, GIs should be told to confess to anything, whatever, right from the start. But the assertion that he came through unscathed, warm and humorous and psychically sound, just isn't plausible. It doesn't happen that way. Now, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. A lot of people, including vets, don't believe that PTSD exists. I didn't. One reason is that they tend to think of it as something verging on the psychotic, as for example seeing non-existent snipers in the hedgerows of suburban Philadelphia. The other common notion is that those who have it dive under tables at the sound of a backfire. Vets tend to think, I don't know anybody like that. I certainly don't see snipers in the rafters. This whole PTSD business sounds like a crock. So it does, but it isn't. And of course, many people, chiefly men, regard with suspicion anything that smells of psychobabble, anything touchy-feely. To them, PTSD sounds like can't-get-a-date personality disorder, something for Oprah to talk about to bored housewives. So they dismiss it. Let me debabble the discussion and state a simple fact. A lot of guys come back from a war as really, truly messed up in the head, and it doesn't go away. They aren't going to talk to you about it. They figure it's none of your damn business. If you push, they'll tell you so, angrily. If you weren't in those forsaken paddies, they think, if you didn't go through what they did, you're off their radar screens. They'll talk to you about football, the weather, and whatever happened in the newspaper yesterday. Just don't even try to talk about Vietnam or whatever war it was. They don't want to think about it, and talking about it to weenies feels like being naked in a train station. There are a lot of these brain-burned guys out there. They don't want your pity. They don't pity themselves. They just don't want to expose that part of themselves to you. They put a wall around themselves. You can't see it, but it's there. Often they seem like fairly normal guys with three divorces who drink too much, and their children say, it was like he was somewhere else. Perfectly normal guys who've had 17 jobs because their bosses are always useless bastards. Perfectly normal guys who live out in the desert and do serious scuba or hang glide because they just don't give a damn. Not all. Some manage to hold it together and become things thought to be respectable, such as senators or writers or defense attorneys. A subsurface load of hostility can be useful in a trial lawyer. Anger is energizing. It can fuel a career. With PTSD, or whatever you want to call it, the anger is the giveaway. These vets carry a load of subterranean fury that you don't want to look at. As they would say, I'll ignore that. I know a lot of these guys. A buddy of mine, two tours in bad places, killed a whole lot of people up close, now has no tolerance for frustration. He's ready to spread your teeth over a wide radius if you even seem to think about getting in his face. Admirable? No. But don't make the experiment. Sounds like McCain. His explosiveness is notorious. Another guy I know, writer, freelanced all his life because he couldn't get along with people in offices. A writer can package this as sturdy independence, as being a colorful maverick. The fellow is approximately sane, or at least apparently sane. Get three drinks in him, bring up the war, and his voice starts shaking and it's time to change the subject. Right now. A fair few PTSD guys become writers. It's solitary, you don't have to put up with bosses, and you don't have to be stable. How do these vets get this way? Not by anything you want to hear about, anything that you'll see on the nightly news. The RPG hits your tank, the cherry juice cooks off, and three of your buddies burn to death screaming because they couldn't get out fast enough. You lose a leg and half your face to a mortar round. You just see things. A Chi-Com 122 cuts a cyclo driver in half, and you watch him trying to crawl with his guts hanging out. He doesn't crawl long. You get shot down over Hanoi and spend years being tortured. The military's a fun place. You have all sorts of unusual experiences. It messes up your head, I promise. I said anger. Yes, but anger at what? At whom? Here I'm on soft ground because vets don't talk about much about this stuff amongst themselves. At least those I know don't. But to the extent that I'm competent to judge, they aren't mad at those who shot them or shot at them. The VC were only doing their job. They hate those who sent them to a pointless war, who exposed them in thousands to Agent Orange, knowing that it was poisonous and carcinogenic. At those posing fat-ass Poles who sent them to die for nothing while they ate prime rib in D.C. Or they just hate. Psychologically, the verb can be intransitive. They don't know what they hate, but don't get in the way of it. Not all respond this way. Some choose to intensify their patriotism. It avoids admitting that you've been suckered, and direct their hatred at the hippies, the liberals, the press, all of whom they figured lost the war. But the anger's still there. Most of the time you don't notice it. They turn off, often seeing emotionally cold. But that explosive venom remains. We're not talking about a fierce Irish temper, we're talking half crazy. Those who seek help, typically from the VA, end up on this adole and that adole, on antidepressants and calmants and even antipsychotics. They sorta help. Sorta isn't good enough with men who control carrier battle groups. From the New York Times story, quote, Mr. McCain also learned to control his temper and not to become angry over insignificant things, the doctor said, close quote. I don't believe it. It doesn't fit accounts of people who knew him. It's not how heads work. McCain is well known for his violent and irrational temper. A friend of mine, Ken Smith, was flacked for Governor Meacham in Arizona during a meeting with McCain. The governor somehow irritated McCain, says Ken. McCain was leaning forward with a clenched fist. I reached out my left arm as politely and non-threateningly as I could, and I pushed McCain back. What I remember is how taut and hard his body was, not from working out and lifting weights, but rather from anger and adrenaline. I made an excuse to leave and get them apart. For what he went through in Vietnamese jails, he deserves sympathy and admiration. It is not qualification for the presidency. That was Fred Reed writing in his blog, Fred on Everything. The time is 12:38. The station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. As with so many of the articles I read, this one is not for you, but for the people in your world you might be able to influence. I know I'm usually preaching to the choir, but you might be able to use what I provide to influence others. This one is titled Lefties for Obama by Ira Chernus, Smirking Chimp. If you've decided to vote for a third-party candidate for president, or not to vote at all because you can't stand voting for the lesser of two evils, this message is for you. You may be taking a lot of criticism for standing on your principles. I know how the criticism can hurt. I took the same kind of heat 8 years ago as a Ralph Nader supporter in a razor-thin election. I never regretted that choice. I felt totally comfortable with it in 2000, partly because the outcome was a foregone conclusion in my home state. My vote would not make any difference one way or another. This year is very different because in my state, the Obama-McCain race is much too close to call. If that's true in your state, too, or if there's any chance Obama might not win your state, please consider carefully the other big difference between 2000 and 2008. Back then, I failed to imagine how much damage 8 years of Republican rule would do. Now the thought of another 8 or even 4 years of the same seems intolerable. Imagine what the Supreme Court might look like 4 years from now under a President McCain. That makes the thought even worse than intolerable. And if a President McCain were to die in office, well, golly gee, sometimes the good old English language just doesn't got the words to express the horror. When the greater of two evils gets bad enough, the lesser is so much less that it really is the better choice. So I'm out there working for Obama and the Democrats. I won't scold you or look down on you for taking the opposite course, but I'd like you to consider changing your mind. No, Obama is not the kind of crusader for progressive causes that you and I would like to see lead this country. But he has a different view than you or I might have about. But he has a different view than you or I might have about how the government works. In his years as a community organizer, he learned that you should never expect government officials to initiate change. That's not their job. This is a democracy, and they're elected to do the will of the people, to bend whichever way the political wind blows. Obama really means it when he says, in effect, making change is your job. I want you to pressure me. If you put a lot of pressure on me, I'm willing to bend to your will. But the conservatives are always out there putting pressure on me from the other side. You have to create a political wind strong enough to blow the opposition away and blow your elected leaders to the left. That's quoting Obama. With Democrats in power in Congress and the White House, the doors of power will be open at least a little bit to progressives. We won't get all or even most of what we want. But there will be people in Washington willing to listen to our views. Some of them will be in pretty high places. And they'll know that our movement will get attention even in the Oval Office, if it's massive, well-organized, and highly visible. McCain and Palin aren't going to move an inch to the left, no matter how powerful the political winds are. They'll claim that their victory gave them a mandate for right-wing intransigence. And if they win, the disappointment may take all the wind out of the progressive sails. After 8 years of fighting Bush, who will have the energy left for another 4 years of the same? A McCain victory might convince a lot of people across the political board that we're just fated or doomed to have a Republican president forever. I'm especially concerned about the huge number of young voters supporting Obama, thousands of them working full-time on his campaign and learning invaluable political skills. If he loses, most of them may be so dispirited that they'll give up on politics altogether for a long time, perhaps forever. If he wins and then doesn't produce the change they want, they may turn their energy and skills to the left, as so many did in the 60s. And it's pretty predictable that a President Obama would not produce nearly as much change as most of his young supporters want. He has chosen to be a compromiser. He understands how much power conservatives have these days. A president who wants to get anything done must have a working relationship with those conservatives, or else they'll simply block everything. So he's taken all sorts of moderate stands to let conservatives know that he doesn't plan to shut them out. The alternative is to stand on principle and paralyze the government, ensuring there won't be any progressive change at all. Let me interrupt with my own comment. Remember what happened to JFK when he moved too fast and tried to change too much. Back to this article. The few changes that Democrats would bring may not seem very significant to you, but they could mean a great deal for those who have no voice and no power at all. Here at home, there are millions of poor people who depend on government programs for their basic needs. Democrats will respond to some of those needs, while Republicans will ignore them and blame the poor for their own suffering. There are nearly 50 million without health insurance. Democrats are at least moving toward covering all of the children and most of the adults amongst them. The number of unemployed grows daily. Obama's talk about giving them jobs by rebuilding the infrastructure and creating alternative energy technology won't all be transformed into action. Some of it will. On the other side of the world, people in Iraq are suffering daily under a U.S. occupation that Obama would significantly reduce and perhaps eventually end completely. Around the world, there are government leaders eager to talk with the President of the United States, talks that Obama would have but McCain would reject. Then there are all the non-human species who are at risk every day from the Republicans' callous disregard for the environment. Democrats won't save all of them, but they'll give many species a better chance to survive. The voiceless depend on us to speak up for them, not just on Election Day, but every day after that. We have to keep pushing relentlessly to the left. We have to recognize that in politics, no one wins all the time. But even a small victory on one issue can make a huge difference for a lot of people, most of them people we'll never see. Yet all our pushing for victories will do little good unless Obama and the Democrats win. That was Ira Chernus writing in SmirkingChimp.com. Next one is a good one. Can the GOP steal the election again? You betcha. It's by Ernest Partridge, Smirking Chimp. John McCain's campaign is imploding as the presidential candidate lapses into incoherence and petulance, and his running mate becomes a national laughingstock. In the face of an impending economic meltdown, the Democratic candidates, Obama and Biden, appear to be the only adults in the contest. Meanwhile, the GOP's erstwhile dependable allies, the corporate media, are displaying moments of journalistic integrity. This presents a problem for the Republican ticket, for as Stephen Colbert aptly observed, reality has a liberal bias. And so the polls showing an expanding lead for Obama over McCain, with no clear indication that the trend might reverse. Conventional political wisdom tells us that Barack Obama and Joe Biden may be on the road to a substantial victory in November. Sorry, folks, but I'll have to rain on this parade. Have you forgotten? Private Republican corporations count and compile the votes with secret and unverifiable software, just as they did in 2000 and in 2004, and we all know how that turned out. Accordingly, the stark fact remains the Republicans might win this election regardless of the preference of the voters. The culprits who rigged the previous elections are fully aware that they might face hard time in the federal slammer if President Obama's attorney general is ordered to investigate past elections. Thus, they're acutely motivated to use their considerable resources to keep Obama out of the White House. And that's just the beginning. The GOP is waging a multi-front war on our democracy. As Mark Crispin Miller describes the situation in a recent email, quote, "The ground has been prepared for yet another stolen race, Bush-Cheney's party having made enormous strides in sabotaging our election system, while the Democrats just sat there whistling. Now, from coast to coast, it's far more difficult for Democrats to register to vote. It's far more difficult for Democrats to cast their votes, while countless Democratic voters have been stricken from the rolls through purges carried out by the Department of Justice. Thus, Bush's government has legally diminished the electorate, the Roberts Court approving every step. Meanwhile, the regime also continues to suppress the Democratic vote illegally, either through voter caging prior to Election Day, or far more effectively, by fiddling with the numbers electronically at every level, and or simply dumping countless names of Democrats from the electronic voter rolls, and or putting far too few machines in Democratic polling places, and or disinforming Democratic voters as to when and where to cast their votes, and or simply scaring Democratic voters into staying home. Happy talk notwithstanding, the situation facing the Democrats is desperate, but it's not hopeless. However, if the Obama-Biden team is to win, it must win big. Less than 60% of the actual popular vote puts the contest into the Diebold zone. whereby a McCain-Palin win becomes plausible in the public mind, and the paperless GOP voting machines and their secret software take care of the rest. That big win is within reach, but only through determined and energetic activity by the supporters of the Democratic candidates and through brilliant tactics and inspiring leadership by the Democratic candidates and their managers, in particular, registration and turnout. The coordinated Republican effort at massive disenfranchisement can and must be overwhelmed. If, as is likely, the GOP succeeds in keeping as many as 5 million Democratic voters from the polls, the Democrats in turn must register and send to the polls 10 million more. In addition, the word must get out that no one can assume that his or her vote is secure. Citizens must be urged to validate their registration status immediately. They can do so by contacting their registrar of voters, and then it gives a link. Publicizing the electoral integrity issue. The looming probability of another stolen election must be made vivid in the public consciousness. To date, the corporate media has refused to investigate and report election fraud, and the Democratic Party, amazingly, has behaved as if it either doesn't know or doesn't care that it has been robbed of election victories time and again. All this despite the fact that electoral irregularities have been staring us in the face. The butterfly ballots. The Holocaust survivors for Buchanan in Palm Beach, Florida in 2000. The lost 16,000 Democratic votes in the 2000 Florida 13th Congressional District, congressional election. The Diebold president's visit to Atlanta just prior to the 2002 election that cost the highly favored Max Cleland his Senate seat. The destroyed and lost evidence in the 2004 Ohio election, and much, much more. In the face of such irregularities, and despite the media embargo, much of the public is suspicious of the electoral process. A September 2006 Zogby poll disclosed that less than half of the American public was, quote, very confident, and about a third not at all confident, that George Bush won the 2004 election, fair and square. The suspicion must now be amplified and transformed into a demand that the next election be fair and square, validating the vote. Independent exit polls must be employed in battleground states that use paperless direct recording electronic voting machines. In these states, the Attorney General and the Secretaries of State must secure evidence, such as computer hard drives, ballots, registration rolls, and make it abundantly clear that destruction or hiding of such evidence will be prosecuted, as will any vote rigging that might be disclosed by such evidence. In Ohio, the unexplained and illegal destruction of 2004 voting records of 55 of the 80 counties and the disappearance of crucial computer hard drives have gone unpunished. This lost evidence alone might have proved the theft of the Ohio electoral votes, and with them the theft of the national election. There are other means of exposing and deterring election fraud, which unfortunately are unlikely to be employed this close to the election. In randomly selective precincts, a few DRE machines might be removed and examined for accuracy. A voter might be asked to vote both on the DRE machines and on paper ballots, with a total subsequently compared. Independent and parallel means of totally compiling and transmitting election results would uncover illegal alteration of the vote. Absent these effective modes of validation, it is essential that a massive number of Democratic poll workers and poll watchers equipped with video cameras be on hand on election day. The stakes. John McCain has repeatedly betrayed an inadequate and confused knowledge of foreign affairs, as he refers to non-existent countries and non-existent borders, confuses Shias and Sunnis, and fails to recognize leaders of alien nations. His economic policy consists of recantations of discredited slogans. Given John McCain's age and physical condition, it's likely that if the Republican team wins in November, Sarah Palin will one day become president of the United States, either during or following McCain's term of office. As Palin proves almost every time she opens her mouth, no candidate in U.S. history has been less qualified for that office. Still worse, her repertory of bizarre religious beliefs is downright frightening. Beliefs in witchcraft, young earth creationism, the end of days, a denial of anthropogenic climate change, absolute prohibition of abortion, and stem cell research, all of these are profoundly discordant with the problems faced by a great power in the 21st century. The traditional Republican power base of financiers, business people, corporate managers, etc., has seen control of their party slip into the hands of religious zealots and market dogmatists. The religious fundamentalists recruited by the Republicans to supply the votes required for political clout have taken over the party, to the point of installing one of their own as the vice presidential candidate. As a result, many influential conservative Republicans have declared outright that they cannot align themselves with the religious right, and with Sarah Palin in particular. Amongst these apostates are George Will, David Brooks, Charles Krauthammer, Kathleen Parker, and David Frum. No doubt there are many, many more, some of whom will be heard of in these final 4 weeks before the election. Many of these individuals are caught in a difficult dilemma as they realize that in spite of what might be good for their party, the election of McCain and Palin might not be good for the nation, its economy, and its international reputation. Those who place their loyalty to their country above their loyalty to their party might soon step forward and be heard. While the Republican Party, they might say, can survive defeat in November, the United States might not survive a McCain and eventually a Palin presidency. Summing up, as Election Day approaches, the public clamor for change in Washington must become sufficiently intense that the media cannot ignore it, and the Republicans dare not resist it. There must be an intensity of rejection of the party in power, combined with uniting behind a reformer that has not been seen since FDR's election in 1932. Given the breadth and depth of corruption and lawlessness in the Bush-Cheney regime, the unpopularity of the Iraq War, and the collapse of the economy, such a time might again be upon us. The usually pessimistic David Michael Green concedes that much. It's been a bumpy ride, 2008. This election should have been an earthquake, a hurricane, a tsunami, pick your natural disaster metaphor, just waiting for the calendar to run out and make it official. In the end, it looks like that's how it will be after all. One gets the sense now that the laws of physics are finally reasserting themselves, and modest measures of sanity are stubbornly reclaiming their inevitable places. This is true both in the proximate sense, as election 2008 now appears to be coming in for a landing, but also more broadly, as the last year or so perhaps marks the end of an era in American politics. It remains to be seen if Barack Obama can survive the smears about to be dumped on him and emerge in the public mind as a plausible instrument of hope and renewal. If so, it's just possible that an overwhelming outpouring of public support just might overcome another Republican attempt to steal the election. At this moment, a month away from the election, the issue is very much in doubt. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Yes, in regards to denying people the right to vote, registration problems. Greg Palast and Bobby Kennedy have just put out an informational comic book called Steal Back Your Vote. And it's on the website as well, steal backyourvote.com. And it tells about all the ways that people have been illegally disqualified from voting.
Okay,
and
thank
what
you.
They can do about it.
Thank you very much for that.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
And just to let you know, I am trying to get Bobby Kennedy Jr. on the air for the pledge drive. We'll see if that's successful or not. Okay, I can't find it. I'm going to try and paraphrase. A doctor was talking to an old rancher, and they were talking about Sarah Palin, and the old rancher said, "Oh, she's a post-turtle." Dr. Scratchit said, and says, "What on earth is a post-turtle?" Well, the rancher said, "A post-turtle is a turtle up on a post. He doesn't know how he got there. He doesn't know what to do about getting down. He doesn't know what to do about his situation. And some damn fool put him up there." Okay. Thanks for listening.